Welcome back. Top of the second hour to conclude this thought, and then to the phones, the economics of impertinence. Alvin Toffler, Future Shock. In the past, permanence was the ideal, whether engaged in handcrafting a pair of boots or in constructing a cathedral. There used to be a shoe repair shop in Spokane, Washington. Those people, it was a generational shop, you know, family of folks that were craftsmen. Amazing stuff. There's still whites, but, you know, it's not the same. A cathedral, all man's creative, in constructing a cathedral, all man's creative and productive energies went toward maximizing the durability of the product. Man built to last. He still should, by the way. He had to. As long as the society around him was relatively unchanging, each object had clearly defined functions, and economic logic dictated the policy of permanence. Even if they had to be repaired now and then, the boots that cost $50 and lasted 10 years were less expensive than those that cost $10 and lasted only a year. As the general rate of change in society accelerates, and again, these are forces that are being brought to bear that are far more profound than people realize. Again, if you're interested, read The Externalization of the Hierarchy, and particularly the accelerating of society, and what, you know, basically it's the devil's handiwork. So as the general rate of change in society accelerates, however, the economics of permanence are and must be replaced by the economics of transience. First, advancing technology tends to lower the cost of manufacture much more rapidly than the cost of repair work. The one is automated. The other remains largely a handcraft operation. This means that it often becomes cheaper to replace than to repair. It is economically sensible to build cheap, unrepairable, throwaway objects, even though they may not last as long as repairable objects. Although, isn't it interesting that these same people want to berate and castigate you and I for harming the environment? Look at how wasteful you are, you know, you prosumers. That's another Tofflerite term. But it's not you and I who are designing and making these products that wear out. Remember the light bulb conspiracy documentary, for example, that says that a group of guys got together and said, hey, we're going to make an agreement between ourselves. We have a secret pact that light bulbs only last 2,000, maybe 2,500 hours, and then they wear out. Why is that? And there's still a fire station in California with a light bulb that's over 100 years old. They have a party every year for it. I think I would be wondering why that one lasts and no others seem to last 100 years. They should last forever. Isn't that harmful for the environment if you're an international industrialist who is making secret agreements to design products with planned obsolescence? The economics of transience, as Toffler put it, seems irresponsible. It seems sinister. You know, we're going to create a market that, you know, a perpetual market for this stuff. We don't want to just create a thing and they buy it and, you know, they have lights in the house for generations. That doesn't work. Westinghouse doesn't want free energy. Are you kidding? Free electricity? Nikola Tesla, what are you thinking? If it doesn't have a meter on it, I don't want it. So, you know, then fast forward 50 years, enter the zero marginal cost, Jeremy Rifkin, the Zero Marginal Cost Society. .com, his book, The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, The Eclipse of Capitalism. This is where this is all headed. And we have decisions to make, and people don't understand the profound implications of what we're dealing with. And it's not just economics. It is this sort of dragnet concept that really incorporates and leads to social engineering in a very coercive yet plausibly deniable sort of fashion, and for very nefarious purposes, I would say. But enough about that. Let's go to the phones and grab Fred in Iowa. Fred, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Fred.
Prussian form of education. I think I can do this in 6 minutes. I'll try. My mother could read. She would be 108 now, I think. At 4 years old, her older sister taught her. Now, my younger brother stayed with my grandmother and walked a quarter of a mile across the field, climbed over a fence, walked across the road, and went to a one-room schoolhouse. Okay, in the 18... Pardon?
If I had to guess, I would say the Bible was probably one of the reading materials.
Yeah, well, this old man will try to cover all that and don't eat up a lot of time.
Yes, sir.
In the 1880s, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Morgan, and another major banker, they had the power, and Rockefeller was the first billionaire. Okay, this Prussian education, 1885-1925. In 1899, the USA adopted this form of education. Now, it's hard for me to read my own writing. Okay, here we go. In our dreams, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves quite perfect docility to our molding hands. The present education conventions fade.
Can
from
I help?
Minds. And unexpired by tradition. Unimpaired by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a gratefully and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, educators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen of whom, can you hear me?
Yes, I was asking, can I help?
Okay.
Can I help?
Yeah, I'm getting the bells. All right. Can you?
Can I read the quote from Frederick Taylor Gates' The Country School of Tomorrow?
Okay.
Published in 1913.
I'm getting deep where you lose your contact. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, and I'm asking, can I help with the quote from Frederick Taylor Gates'
Wait.
The Country School of Tomorrow, published
okay,
in the General Education Board Occasional Papers in 1913?
Yeah. Politicians, statesmen have supply. Rockefeller Education Board, Occasional Paper, number 1, page 6, 1913. Did you get all that I said, and then make your comments there?
I was asking if I could help with the quote, and I mentioned
that
it is Frederick Taylor Gates, The Country School of Tomorrow, as you said, published in the General Education Board Occasional Papers issues. Which issue was that? I think it was issue 1, but yeah, page 6, A Vision of the Remedy is what he called it. So there's this problem, it's problem, reaction, solution. And he talked about, you know, the farm demonstrators of the General Education Board, of which, you know, and this, you know, the financial issue is something that Frederick Taylor Gates talked about in this article. Miseries of Rural Life. Really? Miseries is what he called it. So he said, he wrote, here then is a vast, various, costly educational system of a Christian people unrelated directly or in any effective way, even indirectly, to the earthly life and needs of those for whom it exists and by whose sacrifices it is in the main supported. A putting asunder of what God hath joined together. And for those who don't know, by the way, the reason that this is, you know, couched in Baptist ministry sort of terminology is because Frederick Taylor Gates was indeed a Baptist minister by training, that, as James Corbett pointed out in his Big Oil series, Rockefeller befriended in 1889, and who became John D.'s most trusted philanthropic advisor. So he's writing, you know, we have this problem, the misery of rural life. And so he writes, here are shepherds and there are sheep suffering from hunger, devoured and torn by wolves, and neither knows the other. Can shepherds and sheep be brought together in mutual love and service? And then he writes about the vision of the remedy on page 6, as you mentioned. Is there aught of remedy for this neglect of rural life? You know, we have all these rural people who are left, you know, they're bereft and they don't have a proper education. So Frederick Taylor Gates writes, let us at least yield ourselves to the gratifications of a beautiful dream that there is. In our dream, we have limitless resources. And the hand, excuse me, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. And this is specifically aimed at the rural people, or, you know, general America, if you will, and not the plucked and handpicked folks. So in our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or of science. We are not to raise up from among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we now have ample supply.
Terrific. So, yeah, I thank you for what you just read there and made it a lot clearer. Iowa, for 100 years, had the highest literacy rate in the nation. We're not there now. Now, it's not because Iowa is so smart, but the Midwest and farmers in general, rural people, had a better education. And Iowa specifically, not because I'm from Iowa and try to tote Iowa, but we had the highest literacy rate in the Union for about 100 years. But anyhow, bless your heart, and I'm not going to take up any more time, and have a beautiful day, and bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. Much appreciated. And to hear, you know, I mean, I've seen a family that homesteaded obviously several generations ago in Montana, donated a small, I don't know what some people might call a small lake, but others might call a pond, the fishing pond in western Montana, and people can fish it for free. And there's the story of the family and how the kids, you know, school-age children from 7 or 8 years old would ride horses in the winter to a schoolhouse that was miles away. And, you know, I think it's similar to the story that Fred was telling. And guess what? Somehow they managed to survive. Amazing. And they received a real, actual education, not propaganda, indoctrination, social engineering, you know, cybernetic Skinner box programming. Not that. Maybe I should read the rest of it. The Country School of Tomorrow, in which young and old will be taught in practicable ways how to make rural life beautiful, intelligent, fruitful, recreative, healthful, and joyous. Remember the studies I talked about? The Rockefeller Foundation studying rural life in America. Very interested in what makes rural life tick, and very interesting. I mean, just a you know, millions of dollars actually spent to research what makes this tick and to ostensibly preserve it. Which story? Where am I? I don't, can't put my hands on that right this second, but maybe I'll come back to that. There was the gentleman in particular, the, what is his name? Who was instrumental in that study, and he's kind of legendary. That's obviously not helpful, but so Frederick Taylor Gates, The Country School of Tomorrow, thrown on a screen at a recent conference on rural life, was a series, and this is published in 1913, was a series of photographs of country schoolhouses. See, problem, reaction, solution. This is a much more crude and simplistic application of the dialectical model. Look, we have this problem that we have portrayed or perhaps created. Thrown on a screen at a recent conference on rural life was a series of photographs of country schoolhouses in various states taken by superintendents of rural schools. A few were neatly constructed, and about them were pleasant grounds. The large number were small, one-room structures set on pegs, weather-blackened, window-smashed, often with wrecked entrance steps and lockless door. For chimney, a length of stovepipe thrust through side or back. For furniture, a perpendicular combination of bench and desk, well fitted to be an engine of torture. Oh, see, children are being tortured in these places. It's horrible. Improvement of the grounds had rarely been conceived. On the contrary, the original picturesqueness of wild nature had been defaced and belittered. From November onward, for 3 to 7 months, somewhat less than one half of the school population of the district may be found there. Anyway, painting this awful picture of torture in school when actually what these guys were creating was, you know, a panopticon. We'll be right back.
Are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Joseph Kenzie Howard, that's who I'm thinking of. So, Joseph Kenzie Howard, according to Wikipedia, was an American journalist, historian, and author who wrote extensively about the history, culture, and economic circumstances of Montana. Born February 28, 1906, died August 25, 1951. One of the state's most noted authors of nonfiction, Howard's landmark 1943 book, Montana, High, Wide, and Handsome, is a respected account of Montana history that has influenced later generations of historians. Howard also authored numerous other historic and literary works and was a vocal, articulate, and persuasive advocate for a variety of social, economic, and environmental reforms. Imagine that. Now, take that, skip down forward to this paragraph. The recognition afforded Howard by the response to Montana High, Wide, and Handsome helped open the doors to additional writing, research, and advocacy projects. This whole Wikipedia entry, by the way, reminds me of James Lowen's Lies My Teacher Told Me, and Chapter 6 in particular, and the melodrama that the victors used to paint their historical portrayal. You know, it all unfolded in melodramatic fashion. And in other words, this is an entirely fictional account of the facts, but I digress. So, continuing, in 1944, Howard resigned his position at the Leader to become a staff member of the Montana Study, a research project largely funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. The study was an examination, and you always get the explainer. When you know they're lying, you know they're lying when you hear the explainer, because your mind is going to say, well, that's interesting. And before you can start thinking for yourself and raising your own questions, you get the explainer. Oh, well, that's interesting. And then most people use that to dismiss any other critical thought about the matter. So the study was an examination of life in small town Montana with the goal, see how you get that, the explainer, with the goal of identifying ways to improve the quality of life in such places and thus help ensure their preservation. Uh-huh, wink, wink. Howard remained with the study for 2 years before resigning in order to return to writing full time. So, you know, you read that, and I think if you try to take that at face value, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And if you understand that there are perhaps more nefarious intentions at work here, which there were, enter Frederick Taylor Gates, the Country School of Tomorrow et al., then you start to, I think, see cracks and holes in the cheesecloth of this fictional account of things. So Frederick Taylor Gates is painting this picture in The Country School of Tomorrow, published in 1913. The country school of tomorrow, in which young and old will be taught in practicable ways how to make rural life beautiful, intelligent, fruitful, recreative, healthful, and joyous. Sure. Or, you know, the truth of the matter, if we skip to the punchline, is, as he wrote, in our dream we have limitless resources, which they had at that time, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. That's where we're at now. And that is the kind of the ground zero, if you will, of the bloodless constitutional revolution Thomas McNeice wrote about in his report, The Economics of the Public Interest, to the Rees Committee back in the 1950s. This was the corresponding change in education that had taken place from an impetus outside the local community, and the bloodless constitutional revolution, or the coup, was only successful because education in the United States had been prepared in advance to endorse it in precisely the fashion that Frederick Taylor Gates wrote about. Stick around, we'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Extendivite really works. Here are some reviews from Amazon.com. Nikki, great product. Have to try it for a few months to see results. After taking Extendivite for about 6 months, I have noticed improvement on the numbness of my hands and wrists from carpal tunnel. I will continue to buy the product. Ken Peaks, 5 out of 5 stars. Works as advertised. This formula is very powerful. Be careful to follow directions. I am feeling much better. My heart rate and blood pressure has stabilized, and my lower edema has reduced. Lower leg pain due to blood clots has disappeared. Thank you. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822. Or visit our website at heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company? And it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks.
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive. Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my EaseOff?
Go to EaseOff.com, EazeOff.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new EZ4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri, 417-932-6419.
Ladies and gentlemen, J.R. Moore here. We have a special promotion going on at Republic Broadcasting. This is a fundraiser for Republic Broadcasting involving the Energy Cleaner. Mail me a postcard. My address is at my website at thelibertyman.com. We pick a postcard every other Thursday. When your postcard is drawn out, you get to buy an Energy Cleaner for $215 instead of $285, $70 discount. $200 goes to Republic Broadcasting. You also get a 10% discount on my mattress pads. So get those postcards in, put your name, your telephone number, your email address on there, and when your postcard is drawn, you get to get an Energy Cleaner for $215 instead of $285. Mattress pads, 10% off. Help us out at Republic Broadcasting and help yourself to get an Energy Cleaner at a deep discount. It's a win-win situation for everybody. We hope you can get these postcards in soon. Thank you very much.
Bottom of the second hour of today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast, this Wednesday, September 9th, 2020. I want to get back to this other stuff, but just as a brief aside, speaking of Joseph Kinsey Howard, I would consider his death curious, if not suspicious. He kind of, you know, you might say he is Aaron Russo of sorts, perhaps, you know, writing what he wrote. And for example, from Wikipedia, Howard's first book-length effort was Montana High, Wide, and Handsome, which was published in 1943. The volume was both a thoughtful history of the state and an impassioned indictment of the corporate and bureaucratic forces that had heavily influenced much of that history. Among the book's primary targets were Anaconda Copper, which controlled much of the state's economic and political activity at that time. We've talked about the Copper Kings on this broadcast, for example. And the Great Northern Railway, which had lured thousands of homesteaders onto Montana land that proved wholly unsuitable for farming. Remember, what was it? McClintock, right? the movie. The book, you know, the Land That Hates the Plow. Anyway, the book also paid particular attention to the inappropriate and inequitable usage of the state's scarce water resources, making an open plea for reform of the system. And then the next thing you know, it's kind of the story. It reminds me of, you know, Aaron Russo talking about meeting Nick Rockefeller and hearing, you know, what do you care about those people? So the actual story, you know, if you go look at the archives of the Montana study, the study includes correspondence records from 1943 to 1954. The study formally was ended in 1947, I believe. Yeah, the Montana study officially ended July 19, 1947, due in part. But this is an interesting little... So let me back up a little bit. On July 1, 1944, Ernest O. Melby, chancellor of the University of Montana system, resigned as chancellor and became president of Montana State University at Missoula. He was immediately made responsible for the Montana study. He hired Baker Brownell as project director. Two halftime positions were filled by Paul Meadows, a sociologist from Northwestern University, and Joseph Kinsey Howard, an author and journalist from Great Falls. The project was supported by a statewide advisory group, the Montana Committee. And the, let's see. Oh, here it is. Historical. Okay, so the Montana study was a sociological project. That should be a red flag to most folks. Conducted by the University of Montana under funds provided by the Rockefeller Foundation to use the humanities to contribute to improving the lives of people in small communities. Right. Wink, wink. Why would you do this? As you know, so this is the thing, you know, and we see the same thing happening with Bill Gates, for example, today. Shrewd, cunning, ruthless tyrants in corporate America suddenly become benevolent philanthropists, which should call to mind Gary Allen's The Rockefeller File, Chapter 4, Profit Times Philanthropy Equals Power. So skipping ahead in this historical account, the Montana study officially ended July 19, 1947, due in part to political controversy over its mildly left-wing orientation. I guess you can call it mildly left-wing in by some accounts. I guess that's a relative distinction. So, yeah. And its academic egghead image. However, many of the people involved in the study continued working on the project without official funding, and the Montana study continued to function on an informal basis into the early 1950s. I would say mid-1950s, but, you know. And so you look at, in addition, there are conference materials, employee records, financial records, records of local study groups in Arley, Conrad, Darby, Dixon, Hamilton, Lewiston, Libby, Lone Pine, Stevensville, Troy, Victor, and Woodman. Most of those are tiny places, you would wonder. And so the point is, if you understand what's going on here, I think the big takeaway is these people leave nothing to chance. And everything is studied in minute detail. And, you know, the sociologists say that we can, in Bernaysian fashion, in, you know, Norbert Wiener, cybernetic, B.F. Skinner box sort of fashion, we can understand these people and we can engineer circumstances and their behavior in ways that are ideal, even in these outlying remote areas that don't have, you know, a plethora of black screens, for example. But now the black screens are everywhere. And so, you know, I've talked about being in some of these small towns in years past. And, you know, we've had conversations on this broadcast about Yak, Montana, for example, and people in the Yak talking about the same news that they're talking about in New York City or Los Angeles or Atlanta or wherever. So, and in the same moment. So that's, you know, again, that calls to mind the work of the hierarchy and this knitting together people everywhere. And I think the Montana study is part and parcel to the work of the hierarchy agenda, so to speak. But, you know, again, I mean, these small communities, even smaller at that time, just makes one realize that nothing is left to chance with these people. Everything is studied and meant to be socially engineered. A free-thinking people is dangerous to a broader agenda. So, with that, I want to go back to this other stuff. Getting back to what we talked about yesterday and the effectual outworking of this agenda or the consequences of it, what happens? Well, again, Tom Kersting told us in that interview with Megyn Kelly, titled Psychologist, Florida Shooting Suspect Nicholas Cruz Showed Many Warning Signs. So give this a listen. Go ahead, please.
There's another piece to this also that really will resonate. World War I, the average combat soldier, only 10% of combat soldiers were capable of pulling the trigger at point-blank range. By Vietnam, 80% were. And the difference was that the targets they used during World War I were paper bullseye targets, and the ones they used to train soldiers in Vietnam were human silhouettes. So think of the desensitization just from something as trivial as that. And now, look at the society we live in, with kids playing first shooter video games, being exposed to violent content all day long, mm-hmm. and think about how their mind is absorbing that, and perhaps that plays into why we're having these types of things happening.
I feel like it has to be an all-in approach, right? Because now you're going to get hit by the gaming industry for saying, we've had games forever and they don't make people kill people, and plenty of healthy kids play them and don't kill anybody. And we've had guns forever and most people use them and they don't kill anybody. Mm-hmm. And mental health, mentally unwell people, most of them don't, and we get all that. Right. We get all that.
All of that is true.
Talking about a picture of somebody who all the evidence in raises a red flag. And if we don't get honest about what those red flags are, we're going to stay in the same position that we've been in.
Right.
You know, enough. I was at Fox News for 13 years. I understand very well how pro-Second Amendment people feel, how the NRA feels. It's not about blaming them. It's about getting them in on the problem. And the mental health, the ACLU on the other side. Yes, people have rights not to be involuntarily committed, not to have their rights taken away from them when they show signs of mental illness, of course. But can we at least have a discussion about what the solutions are so we don't wind up with another 17 dead kids at another school next week?
Right. And don't our kids that we send to school every day have rights to be safe?
Right.
Don't they have the right to go to school and feel safe?
Can I just say, today I'm told that in our audience, who's been amazing, you guys, thank you for sitting with us in a show you probably weren't expecting to see. There is a woman named Valerie who...
That's probably enough. Hi. But, you know, and then enter the safe discussion. We have to keep you safe. Which, again, is a relative term according to whose definition. So, that little excerpt, though, psychologist Tom Kersting talking, it was actually 10%. So, it's more than what I was talking about. As he pointed out, you know, World War I, the average combat soldier, only 10% of combat soldiers were able to, you know, shoot at other people at point blank range. By Vietnam, 80% were. That's a complete inversion of the statistics, and the difference was the targets, from paper bullseyes to human silhouettes, as he pointed out. And now, as he said, you skip forward to first person shooter games, which are designed again by the military industrial complex. Who benefits from this? You know, Kissinger is alleged to have said that military men are just dumb, stupid animals, cannon fodder. And Smelly Butler had remarks that I think are similar to that. It's a difficult thing to realize that you have been duped. And, you know, for those who say, yeah, but there are dangerous people around the world, right? And the Donald Rumsfelds tell us that we have to cooperate with those people sometimes or work with them in, you know, high-level, esoteric, bad guy sort of fashion to get things done. You know, sometimes we have to work with people you wouldn't necessarily want as your neighbors. Really? You mean we have to create the Afghan Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and ISIS and Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab, et cetera, et cetera? It's a disingenuous argument, to say the least. So, just to sort of round this out, I want to play a little bit of Ozzie Knezevich's remarks after the Freeman School incident. And again, the Spokesman Review article, September 14, 2017, titled Knezevich, Societal Breakdown to Blame for Freeman School Shooting. And there's more, obviously, but there is an element of truth to this, and this is something that we can control as parents and you know, people in the community. We have a responsibility to some extent. We can't wash our hands of the article, or excuse me, of the issue entirely and just dismiss it as, you know, strategy of tension nonsense. The article mentioned Spokane County Sheriff Ozzie Knezevich blamed a breakdown of society, the media, and problems with the mental health system for Wednesday's tragic school shooting at Freeman High School. Knezevich opened a news conference Thursday afternoon by offering his condolences to the Freeman community. He quickly shifted gears, however, pointing to a host of catalysts that he said were responsible for the violence. Where did we go sideways in raising our kids? He said, all of this violence they consume perhaps has caused a major crisis. Knezevich accused people dressed in black who, quote, commit all types of violence in the name of getting their own way. What do we see these days? Fast forward a little bit. And violent video games for influencing Caleb Sharp, the 15-year-old sophomore at Freeman, who was accused of shooting four students, killing one. Knezevich said investigators were increasingly convinced a preoccupation with school shooting culture played a large part in precipitating the shooting, as opposed to bullying, which was the explanation offered by Sharp. So let's just listen to Ozzie Knezevich for a couple minutes. Go ahead, please.
First of all, I want to remind everybody that the Freeman community is in mourning right now. They have requested that unless they contact you, for you not to contact them. And I hope that you will obey those wishes. Yesterday we had a very tragic situation where one young man decided to walk into a school and shoot his classmates. This is a situation that plays out in our society way too often. And we as a society need to make a determination as to what's causing this. Because I can tell you that 35 years ago isn't that long time, that long ago, and we didn't do that. Where did we really go sideways in raising our kids? Perhaps we taught them to glorify the wrong things. All this violence they constantly consume has come home to pay a major price. It is time for each and every one of us to say no more to the hate that we see, to the violence that we see. We have now a culture where people think that they can dress in black and go out and commit all kinds of acts of violence in the name of trying to get their own way. That's not who we are, folks. It's not the way the system was designed. We deserve, as a society, and quite frankly, our kids deserve, much better than we have given them. It's time for you to wake up. No more hatred, no more radicalized hate. None of this is going to make any sense, because you can't make any sense of the senseless. And this is just senseless violence. That young man was carrying an AR-15 and a handgun. Thank God he had jammed that AR up so badly that it was not going to function. He transitioned to that pistol, and when one of the classmates that he knew came up to him and tried to talk him out of it, he put one round in his midsection and one round in his head. He then indiscriminately started firing, striking three other classmates, who thankfully are now recovering in the hospital. That young man who gave his life stepped into the breach that we as a society have created to save his fellow classmates. The next hero in this is the janitor, Joe Bowen. As soon as Joe saw the situation, the shooter, luckily had ran out of ammunition, had thrown his pistol down, went like this, and Joe confronted him, ordered him to the ground, and then held him there. The school resource deputy was in the middle school, which is right across the street from the high school. He did what he was trained to do. He ran towards that gunfire, went into that school alone.
Pause that there, and you get the message that he, you know, again, as the Spokesman Review article pointed out, he mentions, where did we go wrong? And this is well, back to the article. I'll just read from the article. Knezovich also placed blame on the media, saying it had furthered the school shooting culture that played into Sharp's fixation. This young gentleman got sucked into a counterculture, a culture of violence, he said, and you, media, you're to blame for it. You keep using headlines. You keep giving them names. Sheriff also offered more details about Sharp, specifically about his history with depression. You know, I've talked about this. So you have the medications that are playing into this, and it's just a plethora of ingredients that, you know, the probability leads to we're engineering a culture of this. We've been talking for years now about how, I mean, I've talked about how it's a miracle when you go to SSRIstories.org and you see SSRI Stories is a collection now of over 7,000 stories, most of which were published newspapers or scientific journals. These stories, prescription antidepressant medications are mentioned. Common to all of them is the possibility, sometimes the near certainty, that the drugs caused or were a contributing factor to some negative outcome, suicide, violence, serious physical problems, bad withdrawal reactions, personality change leading to loss of reputation and relationships, etc. 7,000 stories. So you take the medication, you take the social engineering, you take the suspension of disbelief, and the the fantasy culture, which folds in the schizoaffective disorder, all of these kinds of things, the glorification of violence that Ozzie Knezovich was talking about. You go look at Ranker or Gaming Gorilla or any of these popular platforms that rank. Here's an article from that was updated September 8, 2020, just yesterday. The most popular video games right now. Going down the list, number one is Minecraft, but number two, Grand Theft Auto. 5, is that a glorification of violence? 3, Fortnite, of course. 5, Tom Clancy's Rainbow. 6, Siege. 8, Red Dead Redemption 2, 9, Call of Duty Black Ops 2, 10, Call of Duty Black Ops 4, Eleven, Overwatch, which for those who don't know is a team-based multiplayer online first-person shooter video game. 12, Call of Duty Black Ops 3. 13, Call of Duty Black Ops. And these are all FPS or first-person shooter games. 15, Counter-Strike Global Offensive. You know, and another online tactical first-person shooter. So, you know, where is the impetus for all of this coming from? You put all of these things together, and what is the probable outcome of all of this? Then, of course, you have the media, the so-called entertainment, which is largely the Frankfurt School cultural Marxist contingent. And again, you know, from Cybernetics to Littleton, Techniques of Mind Control by Jeffrey Steinberg comes to mind. And, you know, how he said, for the Marxist Freudian revolutionaries of the Frankfurt School, the ultimate antidote to the hated Western Judeo-Christian civilization was to tear that civilization down from the inside, to have it commit suicide by turning out generations of necrophiliacs. And he says, you know, if this statement seems harsh, consider the following. And he refers to Theodore Adorno's Philosophy of Modern Music, published in 1948. Frankfurt School leader Theodore Adorno argued that the purpose of modern music is literally to drive the listener insane. He justified this by asserting that modern society was a hotbed of evil authoritarianism and potential fascism, and that only by first destroying civilization through the spread of all forms of cultural pessimism and perversity could liberation occur. Now, that sounds exactly like what the Daily Signal was cautioning against in this post. You know, some schools don't want you to know what they're teaching your kids. Parents should be wary of projects that want to reframe history or train children to see injustice all around them. It's the cultural Marxist contingent. So, skipping ahead, Steinberg writes, its concern is to dominate schizophrenic traits through the aesthetic consciousness music that is, in so doing, it would hope to vindicate insanity as true health. That's what Adorno wrote. And Steinberg adds, necrophilia, he added, is the ultimate expression of true health, quote-unquote, in this sick society. This is where we're at. Maybe, as Knezovich posited, maybe we changed. As he pointed out, guns haven't changed. We have changed. So hopefully it was informative. As always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. We'll catch you on the other side.
Hey, gang. Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Koshertify, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.